Welcome to the Let's Talk About Care podcast. From carehome.co.uk and homecare.co.uk, the leading reviews websites for care homes and home care.
Hi there, it's Jill here, and welcome to episode 28 of the Let's Talk About Care podcast. Here I talk to comedian and author Pope Lonergan, who was also a care worker and is about to publish his first novel, I'll Die After Bingo, which depicts his 9.5 years spent caring for care home residents. Here we talk about his raw and honest account as his time working in the sector, as well as his thoughts on care workers' wages, the need for society to appreciate care workers more, and the value of the work they do, as well as his own encounters as his time working in care homes. I hope you enjoy this edition. Oh, and just to warn you, there's just a little bit of swearing.
The Let's Talk About Care podcast.
First of all, Pope, congratulations with the publication of your book, I'll Die After Bingo. Can you give us a brief description of what it's about and why you wrote it?
Oh, absolutely. So I say it's a comic memoir, but I try to strike a nice balance between comedy and drama. So there is some serious points made in the book, but I am first and foremost a stand-up comedian. So, I that is my outlook on life is generally a comedic one, but it's a comedy memoir about elderly care, care in general, care ethics, nursing, compassion, all that stuff. And I worked as a care worker in a care home, various care homes for 9.5 years. And it's, I like I say in the book, it's a deeply like idiosyncratic, unique account. I'm not saying I'm a stand-in for every single carer. Like, I'm a bit of a nutbag in a lot of ways, a bit of a weird character, but I hope that other people in the profession recognize a lot of the anecdotes that I'm telling in the book and find the universal aspects of the care professions.
Because it's not even released yet, and yet so far the newspapers such as The Guardian and the Evening Standard have given you great reviews, and you've received a fantastic review from David Baddiel. How did that make you feel?
Ah, no, it meant the world to me. It was the feedback and response has been just hyper positive so far. I've got more reviews that will be following when the book actually comes out, and I'm bracing myself for maybe some negative ones. I don't know. I think the only thing I'm anticipating is it comes from a very particular political perspective, maybe. Like, I've got a political identity that's usually, like a lot of people, I think, I have my firm convictions, but it's usually in a state of flux. But I think maybe there's other certain newspapers and publications that run counter to my own political outlooks that may not agree with the politics of the book, but luckily that, it isn't hyper political, so that doesn't weigh it down too much or alienate people, I hope.
But as far as wages are concerned and things like that, you go on quite a bit about that in your book as well, don't you?
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. It's like the clap for carers, like, it is a nice gesture. Like, we talk about the lack of self-esteem amongst care staff, and we kind of seen it's I always say, like, what crazy kind of meritocracy are we living in where someone who works as a carer, and it's a noble profession, socially is on the lower end of the spectrum, like, depending on what you're using as your criteria or what you're using as a gauge. But for a long time, I felt a bit of shame. I felt a bit shamed to say I was a carer, because there seemed to be some kind of social stigma that is just populated by careless people, uneducated people with a compassion deficit, people who've run out of choice. And it's like, it's not that at all. Like, that is, you obviously you have your bad people within the care sector, and I think there needs to be more professionalization and incentivization to improve it as a career. But yeah, like one, all well and good clapping and, you know, whacking a couple of knackers together or whatever, but a nice bit of a wage bump would be a better gesture, I think. That'd be a more robust gesture if you paid us a livable wage, because, you know, the people who go into this job, they're not even earning enough money. They're caring for the elders, caring for people who are disabled, caring for members of society that are usually the most marginalised, and they're unable to put away money for their own elderly years, you know, for their own pension or other problems arising in their life. So yeah, they're caring for others while sacrificing themselves or the care they may require in old age, because there just is not enough money. In the Edinburgh Fringe, I was working for the comedian called Phil Ellis, brilliant, funny comedian. And as part of his show, he usually has like a few different people, like additional characters within the show. And my entire role during the Edinburgh Fringe was to start his show up dressed as a clown, but a really rubbish tubby clown with really rubbish, kind of half-baked makeup. And I got paid £3 more per hour to do that than I do with, you know, enabling the continuation of a person's life. I got paid more to suck off a trombone and to keep another human being alive, not just alive, but helping them to thrive as well.
Yeah, so, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, that illustrates the kind of lack of worth that's placed on a carer's role within society.
Yeah, but it just shows how lovely you were, and you actually stuck with it for 9.5 years. And in your book, it said you see that you stay because it gives you connection with kinship with residents, family members, and other staff members. You know, and I just think that's such a lovely line that you wrote in your book. Do you want to explain a bit more? Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it was all about the relationships and establishing them relationships and then maintaining them relationships. And it can be a very thankless job. That people usually aren't patting you on the back or praising you about what you're doing or whatever, but they're moments of intimacy and connection and being very central to a person's life, very embedded in their life, in the very, you know, like very, very intimate, almost family-like way. I just love that. I loved that I could be like a source of comfort to these people, like even if sometimes they couldn't quite place who I was in connection with them, like they couldn't quite place, they knew I was a recognizable presence and I was a comforting presence, and that they wanted me about because they felt safe with me. You know, they saw me and they sort of knew me and they felt safe with me. And I loved that. And I just loved, I loved just being able to develop relationships. It's weird because we meet a lot of these people at the point of decline, so some of them are experienced delusions or, you know, all the stuff that comes with dementia, and their reality is very trying to think of a nice way of saying it. Their reality might run counter to the reality that a lot of us perceive. You know, their minds and their experiences are can become slightly surreal and strange, but we accept them on those terms and we kind of enter into their reality. And it's just fascinating work, isn't it? I think, yeah, and anything that requires you to be very conscientious and to be very mindful of another person's version of reality and how another person is experiencing the world or what impact you're having. And it's almost meditative in a way, because it makes you ensure that you stay anchored to the present and to kind of put your worries and stresses on the back burner and prioritize someone else, another human being, and be very attuned to their wants and needs. And I don't know, sorry, that was a bit of a around the houses answer, but
no at all. Yeah. I think you've summed it up lovely, because another thing in your, well, lots of chapters in your book do contain a lot of bodily fluids, you know, stories with people's bodily fluids. You know, it's just, it's like we've got this perception that we all grow old gracefully, and yet, you know, you do mention a lot of, shall we say, poo and wee in your book. Yeah. Yeah. Stories regarding that. Yeah,
it's a fine line. Like, I didn't want to bodily fluids can be very alienating, and of course we all understand why it can be alienating. I mean, they, you know, you're conditioned to think of, you know, poo and wee as a very private functions and stuff that, you know, spreads bacteria and all that stuff. But I mean, Josie Long on the back of the book said, the book is so irreverent and honest and not twee or sugar-coated. And I'm glad she acknowledged that, because I really didn't want to provide a twee, sentimentalized representation of aging, but also didn't want it to be overwhelmingly brutal or horrible or alienating. I just wanted to get the right balance, because in the patchwork of a care shift, you know, you've got those moments of tenderness and delicacy, and then you've got those moments of, you know, you know, trying to mush up grapes in a stoma bag because someone didn't, you know, to allow the safe passage for the feces. But it's the reason as well is because I think a lot of people turn away from that stuff, or body oriented stuff, understandably so. But when they turn away, that can lead to neglect, that can lead to deprivation.
Yeah.
So I wanted uncomfortable behaviors involving bodily fluids to be, I say, socialized, not socialized as in like just accepted and let them do it, but to know that that can happen. You're obviously encouraging the resident not to do that, and for various reasons, but if it does happen, to extract the shame from it, you know, and say, yeah, this has occurred, it can be uncomfortable because you're not reconciling the person that your mum used to be, you know, very graceful, your dad, you know, the person your mum and dad used to be, with almost an infantilized version that has a preoccupation with poo-poo and wee-wee, etc. I wanted to show that does occur. And I've always just had interest, as in like a scrapbook of like used incontinence pads. It's like, no, just the ideas of how somatic degradation and stuff. Like, I really love James Joyce, the Irish writer, and James Joyce wrote a lot within Ulysses and stuff about, you know, very ahead of its time in that, you know, piss and shit and vomit and any kind of effluent wasn't considered something with literary merit, but he wanted to ennoble the body's lower stratum, the piss, the shit, the vulgarity, you know, he wanted to ennoble that to show that could be tinged with literary merit, mainly because of its verisimilitude, its reality, something that happens to us and happens a lot, even if we'd like to pretend it doesn't, you know, is, and because I was someone who's I've got Crohn's disease, so I've got this very bowel heavy existence and so that's in a very bowel heavy job, like, let's be honest.
Yeah.
And And I think always when you talk to people at care work, the first thing that comes to their head is wiping arses. It's like in the whole job has been kind of, even though we know it's a lot, lot more than that, but that is part of it. That is quite a big part of it. And I wanted to show that in a book that's in a way that's, you know, it's there's a little bit of toilet humor and stuff in there, but then also I wanted to, as a counterweight, be able to like philosophize on shit and bung in a couple of James Joyce quotes to make it seem that there's some intelligent argument to make about the representing bodily fluids. But I think mainly I do have a semi-political goal in mind, which is, as I said, to socialize that behavior in the way of like acknowledge is going on and to extract it from shame, so that when we're talking to family members, we feel we can freely discuss this stuff, you know, without dragging the reputation of the person we talk about through the mud or whatever.
Because you see that in the book, that sort of like the don't tell family members about your experiences of obviously, you know, when things happen in the toilet with the residents, you know, and that's kept away from the family. And like what you say, you know, you're trying to say it's so important that they do know or get to know.
Just for like so we can kind of all come up with a solution to try and curb that behavior, because as we said, we encourage people away from that behavior, but also knowing that aberrant behaviors do occur, and keeping the family in the loop and saying, oh, we found out that we figured out there's this diversionary tactic we've come up with that prevents it, or it can work around it. And I just think there's something slightly kind of unethical about very sanitized representations of care homes and care work, because it's not preparing people. I want people to become inured to the realities of the care environment. And they go in with just these massive misconceptions that it's all going to be, you know, soft focus lighting and tea and sympathy. And this one, everyone's starting a choir every other day of the week. And like, no, there's some beautiful things where people are starting a choir. But then there's also this one where this resident needs an enema, or tried to give himself an enema with a marker pen or whatever it is. Like, you just don't know. So yeah, I want to say that I want to show people that can be the case as well. There are also lovely, wonderful moments of connection and playing games and having choirs and all that stuff as well.
You were probably influenced by your grandma, mum and auntie, who all made their careers out of either being a nurse or care workers. How much of that do you think did play a big part on your decision to become a care worker yourself?
Yeah, I as I was writing the book, it sort of didn't really click into place, I suppose, subconsciously. The reason I went into care work was just at the time I was in university and my cousin, I needed a job. My cousin knew someone who could get me a job there. And so my mum would have to kind of in the end, she didn't give in to it. And like, I just had to cope, but she would pick me up from school, and then she was working in the care home at the time. So I'd go in the care home. And so I was very familiar with those environments and felt quite comfortable there. But if anything, I think it's more like a worldview or an outlook. Like my mum would always emphasize. I mean, she's like really like kind of unapologetically bolshy, like 5'2" Essex mum. But then she's also got a side where she'll like go above and beyond to help people out. She's amazing in a crisis. Like people would always come to her during a crisis. And I suppose some of that. And she has a very overdeveloped sense of injustice. Like, she sees there's an injustice, someone's having to, you know, experiencing some kind of something that's unjust, that she has to try and help them and help people. And my dad being a detective, you know, he probably's got that slightly binary Manichean morality that some policemen can have, where it's quite black and white. Mine's not so much that, but helping people, and then like all living things are sacrosanct. So I'd love to like handle insects and bugs and stuff when I was young, but I'd always be like, they'd stress that you mustn't hurt the animal. You can observe it, but then you put it back in its surroundings, and just treating things. So I don't even kill flies now. Like, I literally don't kill anything. I suppose that being of service to people and helping people has been inculcated in me from an early age.
So when did you turn to comedy then?
I did my first ever gig in October 2016. I went full time as a comedian I still would keep my toe in with care work, but I'd only do like one 14-hour shift at this point, or maybe two if they really needed me, in the back end of 2018. Then had a good year of, you know, like a heavy gig schedule and getting by on stand up, and then the pandemic happened, absolutely decimated live comedy, which luckily I've managed to build up my my gig schedule again, and you know, stuff in the book and that.
It gave you time to write this book, didn't
yeah,
it?
Exactly, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I did go back, even though I had the money from the book, so I was actually set financially. I did go back to care work, and I only do 10 hours a week, and it's like one-to-one care with this guy that I love looking after him and caring for him. It's nice to be just focused on one person. So yeah, I still keep my toe in and just take him for days out, or, you know, take him for a visit up, you know, to the church or whatever. And I mainly did that as like to help with the relief effort. I knew how hard, obviously, people were finding it during COVID, and how many staff shortages there were, which, like, staff shortages on top of staff shortages is just really compounding the problem. So I thought, I'll help out. It's not much, but like, I just thought, I like doing it. So I still do that about 10 hours a week.
Yeah. Oh, that's lovely. And you also, you do the care home tour. So you've said in the book that you work with residents and perform with them.
Yeah.
So what's that, and what's the response been like?
So yeah, it was a bit of trial and error. Like, I'll start with this little story first of all. Like, so one of the comedians for a show we did had this idea that was a bit of like a conceptual idea, but he thought it might be quite nice. We said the main purpose of these shows is just to facilitate interaction. That is it, just to facilitate interaction and engagement, and just get people talking to each other. And the show, in very loose terminology, could fall apart at any time, and it doesn't matter. Like, you can still play with it, and I'll come on to that, but one of his ideas was to bring in this box. It was going to be an empty box, but he was going to pass it amongst the residents, and they can fill it with like cherished memories, or, you know, the things that they hold dear to themselves, or, you know, that sort of thing. But they like misunderstood the conceptual part of it, and started putting in their loose change and wedding rings. So what should have been like a fun afternoon became like an inadvertent mugging. from us, and it seemed very suspect. So we had to give the rings and the change back. So, but it was just funny. Like, just they were like just reluctantly started putting all their items in, and we're like, oh no, we don't. This isn't what this is supposed to be. I realised that having worked in care, that music. Stuff with a musical component is really well catered for, rightly so. We know it has this very animating, revitalising effect, even to people who've, you know, they're quite advanced in the neurodegeneration, but they still remember song lyrics, you know, they still remember tunes. So it's kind of amazing to see that. but like comedy and stuff wasn't being catered for. And I realized anything that's the like linguistic, like ledger domain of like a feed line punchline joke, the internal logic of that could be quite hard for some of these people to follow. So they wouldn't be able to go, or with an anecdote or storytelling, again, like the narrative beats and stuff, that it might be a bit difficult for them to kind of focus and pay attention to that. But one thing that always got a good response was anything that was like kinetic and visual, and like even stupid things that I just like kick a footstool and go like footstool football, or like just show a bit of antic like clowning energy, and it'd get a really good response. Like they would laugh, or you know, call me a stupid idiot, or you know, stupid sausage or whatever. And I thought, oh, that may be something that we can kind of look into. We could provide that kind of comedy. And it's always been like trial and error. Like we with the comedian Ben Target, who co-created it, he's got a background in like clowning and stuff. I'm a storyteller on stage, and you know, talking about like my crack opiate addiction isn't gonna be good for this audience, so I was just there as to like to kind of help it run smoothly. But Ben was able to get a load of comedians together who have got like a background in clowning and physical comedy and stuff like that, and it was just like all these like just silly things, and like my mate Joz like tied himself up in string, and the residents had to help him like untangle himself, and then they would like bond together to try and come up with a solution for him to untangle himself. But he'd inevitably get more and more tangled, and it was just, yeah, it was all just these silly little things. And I said the sole purpose is just to get people talking, interacting, and you know, making them feel like they're participating, you know, in something.
And rather than just sitting kind of, there.
Exactly that, exactly. I didn't want it to just be like a passive viewing experience, unless they want that. And then some who are just there to go, oh, no, I'm all right, dear, like, I'm perfectly happy. And that's great, like, whatever they're comfortable with. And so when we moved away from like a show or performing at them into this more reactive kind of nebulous format, that's when we realize, oh no, this is, we're really onto something here. And this is where it's like a workshop, and it's always so rewarding, you know, when you go there. Yeah, it's always really
that's
lovely.
The main thing. Yeah.
And they always say, like, when I've spoke to residents after, or even like a week later, they always go, oh, are you and your stupid friends coming back? We'd really love to see them again, like all this stuff. So it's, and that was a woman who's ability to retain information was, you know, greatly impaired, but she remembered that made it an impression on her.
So she
would like say it with a smile, so it was obviously a happy memory for them.
And staying on the care home theme and social care, TV's overloaded with programs about NHS such as 999, What's Your Emergency, and 24 Hours in A&E. Why do you think there are not more programs focusing on the care sector? And can I see your book being turned into a TV series, you know? What's your thoughts?
I always think we hear loads from doctors, they're doing amazing jobs, and I've got all the respect in the world for good doctors, but let us bloody carers like get let us come into the conversation. But it's almost like people don't want to put a microphone or in front of carers or something, because they're just, they feel like they're what's going to come out, what they're going to say isn't going to have any merit, or you know, isn't worth kind of listening to. And I think sometimes that can play a role in that a lot of people they want to give doctors and certain professionals a platform, but they don't necessarily want to do that with carers. I don't know why, but yeah, when it comes to sort of, the book is actually, I've got a deal with a brilliant production company, and we're currently working on an adaptation
Oh, wow.
Of the book. Yeah, thank you.
That's brilliant.
I'm going to ensure it's not that bow heavy, because I think there's a difference between reading about it and actually seeing it. It's a visual medium, so probably going to tone that bit down. But we are working on that at the moment, and I don't know why, I think it's because of the misconceptions around care work, and that people always just assume it is like tea and sympathy.
Yeah.
And they really only want to present a very sentimentalized, like saccharine version of care homes. And I don't know if it's because they're worried it will, it will force audience members to kind of confront their own mortality, and that people would rather live in ignorance about social care and going into care homes. And I mean, there's loads of comic potential, obviously very dark comedy in a lot of ways. And I hope that's something my book does well.
Yeah.
And also does it in a way that's, you know, you've got to balance liberty and decency, so you can say whatever the hell you want, but should you always say, like, you know you're free to say what you want, but when you're working in a job where you have to put other people first, and you see how certain things impact them, like you're maybe more conscious of hurtful, brutal comedy and knowing the knock-on effects of that, so like trying to ensure that doesn't that kind of doesn't overwhelm the message of the book.
Well, your book didn't come across like that. I just thought it was really balanced, both with humour and with a lot with empathy as well from yourself as well.
Oh, that's very kind of you. Thank you.
Yeah,
that's really.
I think that's what comes across. You know, hopefully it'll come across when it does actually come out of a TV production. So very well done with that. It's hard to do.
Thank you very much. That's really, really kind of you. I hope so as well. And I know I'm the person to do it, and because I know I've been in that job. Like I'm not.
You're not on a viewing platform, are you?
Exactly. I'm not like a day tripper. Like I've done this job. I've been deeply embedded in the social care system, and I know all about like the vagaries and frustrations and everything, you know, to do with that environment and that. And I think I'm a bloody good comedian as well. So I think I'll be able to. Yeah, I think I'll be able to make it funny as well.
Brilliant,
so,
yeah.
So, that's
the hardest thing, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's mixing the comedy with the heartache.
Yes, exactly that. Yeah, and I mean, my favourite things always have that, tonally, they're very mixed. But there's a program called Barry, it's an American show, and it's so adept at navigating the drama and the comedy and the tonal shifts of like really brutal extreme violence, and then slapstick vaudeville like visual gags or comedy, and so it can definitely be done,
but you have to warm to the characters as well, and I think that's where you come across as well. You've done
That's very kind. My good friend Michael Wheeler, who's a script writer, a comedy script writer, he's brilliant. He said with comedy especially, is that at the moment they'll sometimes commission shows on almost like where they'll like sort different shows into like different categories, or it's almost like an algorithm sorting, compartmentalizing each of the shows and going, well, does it kind of represent this demographic? Does it do this, do that? Really, with a comedy show, it's just, it could be a very simple premise, but if the characters are robust and believable and, you know, there's a nice mix of dynamics in there, that's like three quarters of the battle for a comedy show. I really hope that I've got characters like that in the book, who, you know, obviously they're based on real life people,
yeah,
people I've crossed, you know, and who I've worked with, I hope I've done it well, but then I hope I've done a good job of it.
Oh, well, I think you have, yeah, and I think other people love it. So if you remind us when your book is going to be available to buy, and that I'll just repeat the title, I'll Die After Bingo.
Yes.
When's it going to be published?
So the 16th of June. Yeah, so it'll be available in a hardback copy and also an audiobook read by me. So if you want this kind of lumpy nasal Essex voice booming at you while you're going to sleep, then get the audiobook.
Brilliant.
I love that doing. I loved doing the audiobook, so I hope you all love it too.
Oh, well, listen, Paul, thank you so much for being my guest today on the Let's Talk About Care podcast. And honestly, good luck with your book. And I can really recommend it to anyone who wants to buy it. It's really good.
Thank you so much for having me on. Yeah, it's been a really lovely chat, and I really appreciate it.
The Let's Talk About Care podcast.
I really hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as I enjoyed talking to Pope. His honesty just shone through regarding how tough it can be working as a care worker and how the government needed to shine a light on care workers in regard to wages and retention. It was also lovely to hear that Pope is still a carer and that he does his care home tours. His book is on sale from 16th of June, and I know it's going to be a great success, and wish Pope all the best with his future. Thanks for listening to this episode, and see you soon.
From carehome.co.uk and homecare.co.uk, the leading reviews websites for care homes and home care.